And you're tuned to WBAI in New York.
Scrape the sky, cold wind ripping down. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Right after Dan Persson's movie review for this week, we will have with us one of my favorite people in the world and one of the most important people ever to change the face of science fiction, Shereen Renee Thomas. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persson's movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. How about a little 70s erotica to invigorate the blood in these cold, cold months? Yeah, I thought that'd get your attention. Over the next 2 weeks, IFC is re-releasing here in New York a couple of films by director Valerian Borowczyk, who started as an animator and then moved into live-action films that toyed with all variety of taboo matter. I first heard of these films back during their initial releases and have long wanted to see them, even though the responses at the time were, to put it mildly, mixed. I chalked it up then to the fact that the two films combined revel unabashed in such subjects as lesbianism, incest, bestiality, and everyone's favorite, the affection of the clergy for young, young boys. Well, I finally got my chance to see the films, and my reaction is...
Well, we're going to have to wait a moment to see what Dan Persson's reaction was, because, Cherie, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. Okay. I just want to make sure you were there and thank Catherine Davis for making this happen. So now we can find out what Dan Persson's reaction was. Okay. Talk to you in a minute or 3 minutes.
To put it mildly, mixed. The film that will be opening this coming weekend, Immoral Tales, is an omnibus of four short stories, and with the exception of the sequence devoted to the Hungarian Countess Elizabeth Bathory, who, according to legend, bathed in the blood of young virgins to retain her youth, it doesn't really qualify as fantasy except by the greatest stretch of the definition. By the way, Paloma Picasso plays Bathory, and going by Borowczyk's interpretation of history, you wouldn't believe how much sapphic frolicking preceded the atrocities, and how much group showering. Lots and lots of group showering, surprising for the 17th century, I think. The actual murders aren't shown. In an inversion of the typical American aesthetic, Borowczyk is perfectly down with graphic, albeit softcore, depiction of any variety of sexuality, not so much with explicit gore. Kind of refreshing in that way. Now, the film that opened this past weekend, The Beast, hosts closer to true fantasy, but here again, your mileage may vary. Part of that is because of the genesis of the film. At one point in The Beast, the young female protagonist, played by Lisbeth Hummel, fantasizes herself being pursued and ravaged in the forest by a fur-covered, human-like, and very well-endowed creature. That sequence was originally intended for Immoral Tales, but instead became the centerpiece around which Borowczyk built a tale about two affluent families consolidating their power through the marriage of their children. And let's just say the hybridization isn't pulled off elegantly. The larger tale has its fantastic and taboo components as well. Plus, sequences of horse breeding so graphically detailed that it had caused discomfort at an animal husbandry seminar. But too much time is spent on rarefied family politics, whether the son will get his baptism, whether a family member who's also a cardinal will bless the union. Altogether, it feels like an awkward concatenation of class satire and blunt sexuality. Bunuel could pull this kind of thing off. Borowczyk doesn't quite nail the landing. All told, both The Beast and Immoral Tales feel like films very much of their time. The 70s was the period when restraints were really lifted off film, and directors were emboldened to explore topics they never could before. And frankly, I don't think they've quite been able to since. We've kind of slipped back in that way. But at times, the zeal to push the envelope overrode all other considerations. There are only so many boobs and pubic close-ups you can take before overload sets in. As erotica, Immoral Tales worked a little better for me than The Beast. Paul Schrader's Cat People, for all its flaws, approached the topic with more elegance and erotic power. Still, few present-day filmmakers, I'm thinking maybe Greg Araki, prime amongst them, are quite as gleefully eager to push buttons as Borowczyk was. I gotta give both Immoral Tales and The Beast points for that, even if I wish I had emerged a little less aroused and a little more amused. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie podcast website, so if you want to catch up on what you missed, please check out MightyMoviePodcast.com.
Oh, my God. What a... Jeez. Okay, everybody, take a cold shower and... But bring your radio in there so that you will... well, let's move on. Good morning, Cherie.
Good morning, Jim.
Okay, now that I have you on the air and everything seems to be working, let me take up a bit of airtime by saying, I think you've heard this rap, and I haven't done it in a while, so I'm forgetting aspects of it. But basically, I think there are five anthologies in science fiction that changed the scope of science fiction. And one of them was probably, I'll toss in some series in there, Star Science Fiction, edited by Frederick Pohl, The Best of the Best, which is an anthology by Judith Merrill that collected her best of. And the reason that hers were so important, the Fred Pohl books took science fiction out of pulp and brought it to literature. The Judith Merrill included writers from around the world and got translators for them. Ooh, all of a sudden, it wasn't just the same-o, people in astounding and amazing stories. Then I guess at that point comes Dangerous Visions, which embodies what was called the new wave of science fiction and gave old masters like Frederick Pohl and newer masters but already published people like Samuel R. Delaney a place, but also launched a lot of unusual writing. Then came Women of Wonder, edited by Pamela Sargent, that said that, you know, all of those people who had two initials before their name, like C.L. Moore and all that, these are women. They've been writing, and here are some others that you should know about. And then in the year 2000, am I correct? Cherie, are you there? Oh, tell me I've lost Cherie now. Yeah, I've lost. Are you there, Cherie? Oh, dear. So I'm going on for so long that I lost her somehow. So I'm going to have to try to ring her back. Or, Cherie, if you can hear me, because I thought I heard a radio in your background, call here. And I gave you that phone number. But then came this book called Dark Matter in 2000. And Dark Matter, and, you know, I don't have a copy in front of me. I have the table of contents, not so. The entire title is something like Dark Matter, a century of speculative fiction from the diaspora of African writers. And that's an important thing. Now, let me see. This is annoying as anything. Let me see if I can do this. I was sort of relying on Kathy before. No. Okay. We're going to try this again. That's not even a dial tone. Maybe one. There we go. It's one of those dial nines first. Okay. And it's not even ringing. There it goes. Hi, Cherie. Hi, okay, well, now let's see if I can get you on. What happened? Did it just give up on you? Okay, yeah, that somehow figures with WBAI being what it is. Hold on. If this does not work, if I do not get you on the air, would you call that phone number I gave you earlier? Okay. Okay, I can actually say that. I'll close my mic and... Okay, you know, you've got that number now, and the audience is none the wiser. They probably know it too, but I just don't need them flooding. So I put you on hold. Hold on. Okay, that's on hold, and I hit this, and I hit this, and with any luck, you're on the air.
Hey.
Ooh, it worked.
All right.
I don't believe it. Okay. What was the last thing you heard me say before I rudely cut you off?
Oh, my gosh. You were talking about...
what book was I up to?
Judith Merrill's collection.
And then...
Kind of literature.
So yeah, then there was Women of Wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And then really comes Dark Matter.
Whoa.
I mean, are there any books... I mean, maybe an argument can be made for Mirror Shades, edited by Bruce Sterling.
Mm-hmm.
Because what that did was that engendered cyberpunk, which as far as I'm concerned is quite over. And that wasn't about much except the genre of writing. Where Dark Matter encapsulated an awareness. It was both a book of consciousness raising for people. As I said, before Dark Matter, I probably could have named eight Black science fiction writers or people of color in science fiction, and I was pretty good at it. And then you came out with a book with what, 5, 10, 15, about 30 people?
Yeah.
But
yeah, I guess, yeah, we had a pretty good range of people.
Yeah, I would say so. And we're going to name a few of them in the moment, now the entire title, I'm always mixing up the latter part and I didn't write it out and I should have. It's Dark Matter, colon, a century
of speculative fiction from the African diaspora.
I was close.
Yeah.
I was close. Okay. I forgot the D word there, diaspora, and I shouldn't have. But this book, A, told us there are many more people that you should know about, that you don't know about, or B, did not wrote speculative fiction. And that was a portion of what it did. I don't know if you were thinking at the time that you put the book together that the book still has its influence every day.
Definitely not. I definitely didn't have that in mind. I really didn't know what to expect. I just know what I wanted to read myself. Mm-hmm. and kind of went about it that way, just trying to uncover, do the excavation, find the work that was out there, and kind of revisit other things that I read before and see it through a different lens. That's what I was trying to do. Didn't really know if anybody else would be as interested into it, as into it, and and as excited about it as I was, but I was hoping.
Yeah.
I suspected that there would be readers who might be interested in reading this kind of work.
I had somebody on the show in the last 2 weeks, and last week I had Jen Brissett, and 2 weeks ago.
Yay, Jen!
Yeah, and 2 weeks ago I had Nora Jemison. So I'm on a winning streak here. And one of them either said or quoted, I wanted to read books that could have me in it. And particularly black women, but also any people of color, were for the most part disenfranchised from the beautiful utopian future that science fiction portrayed. And the other thing that Dark Matter did is it encouraged people to write. They took a look and they said, okay, look at that. There is a genre out there that I can be a part of. And they began writing.
Well, I feel like it, people were out there writing, on their own already. It's just that it was a sense of like, what do I do with it? Where's the audience, and will publishers, be interested in getting it out there? So, it's like some of these writers that I, contacted, I knew they had, work or what have you. And if they were published, they were probably known for other things. But it's just a matter of, creating a space where people felt like, okay, this is something that is alive, is vibrant, it has an audience, and this is something that people are interested in. We have to go back. Here we are in 2014, almost 2015, almost 15 years from when I, started this project. And people really weren't discussing science fiction, particularly black contributions to science fiction beyond Samuel Delaney and Octavia Butler. And, Stephen Barnes and Tananda Reeve do. We were very excited about Nalo Hopkinson. She won this fiction contest from Warner Books, and her, Brown Girl in the Ring came out. And so it was just like, oh, wow, these
and other she, and in 2000, she was pretty much a new face.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, you might have been, lucky if you were kind of reading widely and maybe found some of her short fiction or something.
Well, I lucked out. I met her at ReaderCon.
Oh, wow.
And her partner, a filmmaker. And that's how I discovered her, literally on the lawn outside the hotel. And we turned to talking, and that's how I discovered Nalo Hopkinson. That was mm-hmm. then reiterated. Well, I knew about Brown Girl in the Ring, which I loved, but then you also published, is it Ganger?
Ganger Ball Lightning, yeah.
Yeah, Ganger Ball Lightning. I wasn't sure if it was Ganger or Ganger. I did print out the table of contents just to be sure that I would have that.
I suspect there were people out there doing things already. I know there were writers who had books. And we're, like I said, we're known for other things, and we're just waiting for that moment, that time when it could actually sell the science fiction. I think remember Walter Mosley said that he actually wanted to write science fiction initially and, really couldn't get that kind of off the ground the way he wanted. So he started writing mysteries instead, so he had this amazing mystery career, But if it had gone another way, he would have really loved to written it, you know, in science fiction initially. So, you know,
and now he's
the other way around.
And he's got what, about 4 novels and a novella out now.
Mm-hmm.
One that just came out from Open Road, and Jack Strong. That's the title, Jack Strong, available as an ebook.
But my favorite form is short fiction. So I really love the short stories, and I liked Futureland, that collection, a lot. You know.
Yeah, that was another itch of mine that you scratched, because mm-hmm. I'm such a fan of short stories. And while I am a big fan of many novels by many of these people, there are some of them, including Mosley and Delaney and Kiini, Abu Salam, and others who just have mastered... Bura Salam, excuse me, Kiini. Mm-hmm. I had her on the air 3 months ago, and I'm blowing her name now. And Linda Addison, and all these wonderful folk that have really mastered the form, the short form.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them poetry, like you.
Well, I think there was something special about the short story. You can get in, and they pull you into another world. And it's just very satisfying when it goes full circle. And, you know, and it's the same for novels, but novels are a bigger investment. And, you know, I mean, I've read some books that I generally liked overall, but there were, you know, characters or chapters that I would just, like, you know, skim through it and wait to get to the good part. You know what I mean? And that's a lot of, you know, in a short story, you know, every word has to count. You don't really have time to waste. You know, there aren't any throwaway characters, so you got to get in there and tell that story well and keep it moving. So I really like the short story.
Yeah, I love James Gunn.
So novels can have filler and all kinds of, you know, throat catching. They're not supposed to, but they can, and you forgive them because ultimately it comes together. You know, it can be satisfying, but a short story, man, you got to do it. So it was a lot of fun editing. Dark Matter, a lot of fun, a lot of hard work figuring out which writers to include and which stories from which writers, because I got, you know, multiple stories from some writers that were very different, you know.
Yeah, now what was that? Now I'm going to ask questions, but we need to mention that while it may not be the easiest thing to walk into a bookstore, even online, and pick up a copy of Dark Matter today, you can now, as of now, for the first time in 14 years, get it as an ebook.
Yeah.
So before this show is over, I expect everybody listening to own a copy.
Yeah, it's available as an ebook. I'm so excited. When we did, all the writers got together, we did Dark Matter, there wasn't any ebook available.
The market was just beginning. I had my, I don't even remember the name, I had my Palm computer, which was, mm-hmm. you know, basically the size of a phone today. And you could read electronic books on that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like one, there were two sites, the Electronic Library, and from going way back, there was Project Gutenberg, which only deals in public domain works.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the ebook was a brand new thing.
And I remember Richard Curtis, literary agent, talking to the National Writers Union and trying to get writers to be more vigilant about their ebooks and everything, and then people were looking at him like he was crazy, you know, but he was kind of ahead. He was like, this is going to be part of the publishing format. He was one of those people who, you know, kind of saw it coming on down the line, you know, and he was saying, you really want to think about this as another form. And here we are. we're in that world. You know, but Dark Matter came out December 2nd as an ebook, and I couldn't be happier. I mean, Dark Matter, the second volume, you know, was always available as an ebook, but not the first one. And I'm so just happy they've decided to go ahead and put it back out there.
Yeah, the second book being called Dark Matter Rolling the Bones.
No, Reading the Bones.
Reading the Bones, damn it. I am useless this
You've
morning.
Got to say,
I am so useless. I've already cut you off the air once. I had to have Catherine, that happened before you were listening, Catherine Davis on, to help me set up And my air checking to get you online and all that good stuff. So I'm useless this morning. I just, but I'm useful for one thing. I know how to pick guests.
Thank you.
It's been way too bleeping long since you've done this show, what, maybe 6-7 times?
I know. We've done, like, it's on fundraisers and stuff, yeah.
But besides that, you've been a guest in general. And also importantly, people know I'm always constantly pushing the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, which I curate. But you used to curate.
Yeah.
And you did that for what, one or two seasons?
I did it for one season. It was the New York's best geek experience in the city or something the Village Voice had nominated.
That's right.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Carol Cooper passed the baton to me, and we rock and rolled at the Dixon Theater.
Yeah, and I've known Carol for happily eons, but I think it was through her that I met you.
Mm-hmm.
And she just gave, I said, who's that? And she said, trust me, and I do, and I did. And she was right.
Yeah.
And so she did two seasons, and you did one.
Yeah, the brilliant Carol Cooper. Yeah.
Yeah. Then after that was Paul Witkover, and then I took it over.
Mm-hmm.
And still doing it. And having said that, I should just mention to everybody listening, January 6th, Sarah Pinsker and Daniel Jose Older. So if you want to know the glue that holds them together, it's two musicians.
All right.
People wanted me to put people into a box. I started this season off with somebody who you brought to the series, Walter Mosley. And people said, oh, does that mean you're going to invite Chip? No. Nora? No. What is this, a 3-foot box that everybody has to stand in? So I thought about it for a while, and then I brought in Paul DiFilippo, because Paul DiFilippo is a science fiction writer who's written mysteries. And Walter is a mystery writer who writes science fiction. You want a box? There's a box. Then, still trying to figure out, February is Jen Brissett. March will be a tribute month, probably to R.A. Lafferty. And April are two people named Sam.
Two people named Sam?
Yeah. Sam J. Miller, who won the Shirley Jackson Award this year for short story, and is, it's not right to call him a gay activist. He's an activist and he's gay. He deals mostly with homeless people. That's his job. It's his day job. And the other Sam, you probably call Chip.
Delaney.
Yeah, Samuel R. Delaney, who's one of my first bosses here at WBAI, but I'm, please forgive me, I'm calling it Sam and Janet Evening. Now I'll have to bring in Janet Coleman so we can have Sam and Janet, but it's two Sams, two guys named Sam. So that's the schedule coming up, but you brought a wonderful diversity to that series, and
That was my goal. I wanted to bring in some new blood, some new voices, and see how it went. And I was pretty happy with it. I'm pretty happy with the way it went. You know, curating, you know, a series is, you know, it's sort of like editing. You know, you got to get the right people together, and you know, make sure that they have the good synergy, and that you know, everything flows. You know, so.
Yeah, and it's sort of like editing also, except you only get to do two stories a month. But that's okay. So, that's how I met Terrence Taylor, who's almost I'd say a fairly regular guest on this show.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it be talking vampires or Doctor Who. And nobody can shut me up about Doctor Who.
I met Terrence at the Frederick Douglass Creative Arts Center, where I was teaching, the short fiction workshop. So that was the first time I was introduced to his work. It was wonderful. We knew it was going to be something special. So same thing with Daniel Jose Oder. I mean, these writers were doing, like I said, they were just doing, people were already doing amazing stuff. You know what I mean? They were just on their path.
Yeah.
On their path.
Daniel's first collection of short stories, Salsa Nocturna, is brilliant. And he is a great reader, but he has this band, the Ghost Band. And I'm sure his novel will be fine. I haven't read it yet. He just sent me today the publicity contact to get it, so before we do the reading. But when he reads with his band in the background, it is a whole different experience. One that must be captured. It is, it transcends the story, it transcends the music, it becomes a new medium. And I don't know what to call it, jazz speculative fiction. but it's R&B spec. R&B.
They call it Salsa Nocturna. That's what it is.
Well, yeah, except that when he comes on the air and reads, or when he's been in the studio, he's not brought his band, even though I've urged him to do so. And he's a great reader without the music.
Mm-hmm.
But with the music, I think there's something better. I've got a video that I've got to give him and let me do something with it. And unfortunately, we were going to do it at BAI at 120 Wall Street, where you were a few times. But we lost that building right after Hurricane Sandy. And it was right after we moved to the current single room we have up in Harlem, uptown, that he said, "Hey, can we record that now?" Like, no, Daniel, we don't have space anymore. But if we move to that space in Brooklyn, we'll have wonderful space to do it. So here's hoping. But what was very interesting when you were curating is that it was not simply about people of color, as Tempest prefers the phrase, or writers of the African diaspora. You brought in all kinds of people and all kinds of interesting pairings.
You have to remind me, because I don't know what we talking about over a decade ago.
Well, let's see. You were the first person to bring in Barbara Krasnoff as a reader.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Something that I would not do. Now I can, because you opened the door.
I mean, this is another writer who's doing really nuanced work. You know, I just found her writing very, very moving. And she's just a really humble person. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the story. I just feel like more people needed to hear the work, needed to hear it.
Yeah.
You know?
So it really.
And I was really happy she agreed to do it, because you know, people can tell you no.
Yeah. Now and who? I don't remember who she read with.
Yeah, and that's what I was just blanking on. So thanks for underlining that.
Yeah, it'll come to me at about 3:01.
The other reader, but
yeah, we'll put it on Facebook, and I suspect I know who it is, and I think that she even posted something on Facebook.
Like, I'll have to go back through my archives for that. But we also did we also had theater, and that was something I wasn't sure how it was going to work out. I thought
that was that hummingbird flying backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, I remember that title.
Yeah.
By the and that was my introduction to the wonderful and amazing Andrea Hairston and Pan Morgan.
And Chrysalis Theater, yeah.
Yeah, Chrysalis Theater, who have done two shows since. I've maintained that tradition that you started, and we did one in the last year. Oh, God, now I'm going to forget the title and screw it up. The first word was, I think it was Thunderbird in the New Order, or New World Order.
Mm-hmm.
Ask, now you're working with Professor Hairston at this time, are you not?
Yeah, I am the Lucio Gar Lakes Writer in Residence at Smith, teaching creative writing, particularly short fiction. So I get to have my feet in different worlds in the theater department and in the English department. I'll be visiting Afro-Am. And I'm doing some things with the Writing Center, the Independent Writing Center. So it's gonna be a lot of fun.
That's very cool. Yeah. I mean, I'm annoyed about a particular aspect of it that it... let me explain to the audience. Academics are hard to book for radio and for reading when you tell them that something you're doing is in the middle of the week. They just look at you and cross-eyed and said, you know, it's finals, right? Or something like that. And that has actually frequently been the case with you because you've been teaching in different places. And it's always a problem with Andrea. And Paul Park, who we finally, I think he's on sabbatical or something, so we got him back for the first time in about 10 years, 2 months ago. You academics. But what does that mean?
It'd be different. Like, see, you got seniors four. When I was down the street from you, basically, I could just hop in a cab and go down to the East River.
Yeah.
You know, that was nothing. That was when the show used to come on at, 5 in the morning, right?
Well, during the Hour of the Wolf, yes.
Yeah, during the Hour of the Wolf.
Yeah.
5 to 7.
Yes, 5 to 7 for 39 years.
Yeah. It's dark, and then the sun would rise when you're done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And in between that, the morning twilight, the Varg Teamen is actually the proper term. It's the morning twilight, and it's a Swedish concept. And remember, the morning twilight in Sweden can be 2 or 3 hours long. So Ingmar Bergman made a movie called Hour of the Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
Which will be on TCM sometime this month because they're doing all of Bergman's films. And it's always somewhere in New York, at least, between 5 and 7 a.m. But it basically, the show got canceled. And I was off the air for all of a month. And this was to become a temporary time slot. And it's now fairly embedded. Because we haven't had a single program director long enough to make a permanent decision. And Robert Knight, who you met a couple of times, was on before me. And he passed mm-hmm. away, sadly and way too young early this year. We lost too many people this year. And, of course, she who created Hour of the Wolf, Margot Adler, Margot died in July.
Yeah.
And the person who I came to WBAI to meet when I was 13, Steve Post, died 6 days after Margot. I mean, this year sucks.
It has been an interesting year. It really has.
A better way to put it,
yeah. We're getting ready to dawn into a new one.
Well, yeah, that's the thing.
A lot of new exciting things coming on around the pike.
Yeah, karma has a lot, it's time to swing the other way.
Well, I'm excited about a couple of new projects besides the ebook for Dark Matter, which is like, yay! You know, you don't have to spend $32 on the hardcover anymore.
Yeah, right.
You can get an ebook. I have some short stories that are coming out in the spring, so pretty excited about that. I've got one in a collection called An Alphabet of Embers. It's edited by Rose Lindberg. And I'm really looking forward to seeing, some of the other writers are going to be in it. So that's going to be really cool. And I'm going to be and have another short story that's in Transition magazine out of Harvard. So that's going to be cool. I have some new poems that are going to be out in the January and February issue of Mythic Delirium.
Oh, cool.
Edited by Mike Allen.
Yes. Oh, and guess who else happens to be in that? Barbara Krasnoff.
Oh, good. Oh, cool.
Maybe you'll be in the same issue. That would be neat.
I don't know. If it's the January and February one, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm excited about that. And what else is going on? I'm missing out. I'm missing another short story. But I can't really talk about that one yet. So
okay, yeah. Not sold.
I gotta wait to talk about that one, but I am thrilled. And then there is, I got honorable mention in the Science Fiction Poetry Association's long form category contest that was judged by Kenji Liu.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they just announced that. So that was like, yay! That was pretty nice surprise. And I was an editorial consultant for an anthology that's coming out next year called Octavia's Brood.
Ooh.
And it's science fiction stories from the social justice movement.
Oh, my God. Who's editing
that?
Yeah,
this is a really exciting collection. And it is edited by two dynamic women. Like, they're just, like, these writers, they're just, if you meet them in person, like, I really want you to, like, meet them and talk with them and see how everything goes, because they are just really inspiring.
I'm there, but tell me who they are.
Well, Lita Marisha, she's based out of Portland, Oregon, but she's like a woman of the world. She's everywhere.
Okay.
Hand dog community activist who uses science fiction, speculative fiction, in communities, you know, to help people figure out how to solve problems or how to look at them from a different perspective and figure out ways that they can work together to make things better. And she uses literature, science fiction literature in particular, to help bring those conversations about. She uses them as case studies, her and her co-editor, Adrienne Marie Brown, who's based out of Detroit, Michigan. So
this is going to have to be a phoner, huh? I'm not going to get them both in New York.
They have to, but you know what? They've been around. I mean,
you get them to New York, I will give them a launch party, a reading, a radio show.
Oh, yeah.
These sisters
were launching before the book even came out. So
they
did readings before they even finished the book. So.
You tell them my name and tell them that I've only just heard of them and I'm already a fan.
Yeah. If you go visit their one of their websites, because I think they have a couple, if you go to octaviasbrood.com, you can get more information on them and what the vision was and how they came about doing this project.
Oh, I'm there now. We should explain the title.
Octavia E. Butler. What can I say? She's like one of the pioneers in science fiction.
A queen.
Harlan Ellison helped discover her, encouraged her in his screenwriting class to look at writing fiction seriously when she was a student in I think Pasadena, California. She was accepted into Clarion West in the
70s.
Clarion
Science Fiction Writers Workshop,
really terrific class, and she sold her first stories in that workshop. Clarion is a six-week science fiction writer's workshop that is designed for students who are interested in improving their writing and becoming professional writers in the field to work each week on a different short story, which will be critiqued by their peers and by a amazing, you know, instructor who's most likely, usually a well-known science fiction writer.
And today it's more of a nurturing atmosphere. In the 70s, it was more of a challenge.
It was a challenge right up until 99. Right up to it was a challenge all the way into the 90s. And I think they, they kind of revisited it.
Well, there's a challenge and then there's Harlan.
It was definitely a challenge when when Andrea, Alma, and I, Liz and I were there.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. But it was trial by fire, but it was really, really good. I mean,
I think it's
just the kind of experience you have, you know, just working on your writing, having a chance to meet Octavia Butler or Greg Bear or Nancy Kress.
Or Ursula K. Le Guin, who taught the year that Margot was there.
Oh, yeah.
Joanna Russ, Samuel R. Delaney.
Linda Jones.
Margot's other.
Howard Waldrop, Gordon Van Gelder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ellen Datlow.
You can just go on and on.
Yeah, name a great in science fiction, and they've been a Clarion teacher and may well have been a student.
Hmm. Because but then you meet lifelong friends. You make lifelong friends.
Yeah, they really do cling together. And every so often, I'll have somebody on the show, and it turns out they're the person who didn't go. Like, you know, three times a year, mm-hmm. I'll have a guest who didn't go to Clarion. And every other week, yep, they're all Clarion grads.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a big commitment because you're gone from your regular life for about 6 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you have to travel to wherever it may be. There's one in Australia. There's one on the West Coast. And is there still anything in Michigan?
That, I believe so, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think there's something at
there's one in San Diego.
Yeah, that's Clarion West.
Well, Clarion West is in Seattle. There's another one.
Oh, so there's two on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
That's unfair. That's toppling that's toppling the continent.
Well, there was one in Michigan for ages, right? I don't know if it's still there.
The original was, well, of course, in Pennsylvania, and then went to Michigan, and then the West Coast stopped for a couple of years and came back to the West Coast.
Mm.
So Margo was in 1973, what apparently is called the Lost Clarion, because there hadn't been one on the West Coast before, and there wasn't one for two or three years after. And I thought it was 1974. I was interviewing Steve Miller and Sharon Lee earlier this year, and I was telling them how I got Hour of the Wolf. Was because Margot Adler, host and creator of Hour of the Wolf, went off to Clarion and was 6 weeks long, and I was her substitute. And when she came back, she took a different time slot, and I'm still doing Hour of the Wolf. And I'm telling them this whole story, and he just looks at me and he says, no, it's 1973. I said, excuse me. I know what year I started my radio show, and he said, excuse me, but I know what year we were in the same classroom together.
Oh, yeah, because you don't forget Clarion.
And so I took that as a given, like, oh, okay. So I've been doing the show since 1973. I didn't even realize it. So.
Yeah.
So that's how important it is to people. But that, and it was Steve who told me all about how that became famous as the Lost Clarion. And Sharon Lee is a former president of Science Fiction Writers of America. I think she did something as an honorific to Clarion that was official.
Hmm. Well, I know it's like a, you know, a wonderful starting ground for a lot of writers, including Octavia Butler. And so they have there's a scholarship, I believe, in her honor that helps support writers. I know when I went, the New York Science Fiction Society helped me get, you know, helped me spend the 6 weeks there, the Lunarians. And I was really grateful for that, that support, because otherwise I don't really know how I could have, you know, swung it. At the time I was editing Dark Matter. I was on Deadline, and I really didn't anticipate, like, I hoped I would get accepted, but I didn't expect to. So, so I had already had my schedule together on how I would, you know, what I was working on. So when I found out I was going to have to pack up and go, I was like, ooh, you know, I was over the moon. And then I was like, damn. Oh, excuse me.
Yeah, right.
This is going to be interesting. You know, but it worked out. It worked out. That's where I met Alma Patterson. You know, one of the Andusa, you know.
The wonderful, underrepresented Alma Patterson.
Oh, my God. Just let us speak her name so that we can conjure.
Alma, A-M-A.
The world needs more Alma stories.
Who, it's like, okay, Alma, yeah, you're like a lawyer and a mother and this great writer. And then she turns up at Andrea Hairston's last show in New York, and she's running sound effects and doing voices.
I mean, you can't keep Taliban people down, you know. She's, you know, she comes from a legacy of Taliban anyway. You know, her father is Raymond Patterson, author of 26 Ways of Looking at a Black Man.
No, I did not know that.
Professor emeritus at City College. So, yeah.
Which is where I am right now.
That poetic power in her. But I, that's where I met her, and I met D.C. Shaw there.
Mm-hmm.
And Andrea and our beloved friend Liz Roberts, who passed away. And
whoa! I was unaware of that.
Oh yeah.
Oh good God.
Yeah.
Okay, that's another blow.
Yeah.
Because I met her again through you, and she was another. Amazing person. So let me just say, hey, Liz.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
She was the one.
I wonder.
Reminded me, and I kept complaining about the editorial voice interfering with the writing. You know, she's the one that said, you know, you have to think of it as, you know, wearing your hat or wardrobe, but you just sit that person down. You sit the editor down outside the room and have them wait patiently because you're gonna bring them in at another part of the process, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, she is just like, she always had another way of looking at things.
I must say.
Yeah,
she did not see the world through the same lens.
She was a filmmaker as well, a director, an actor.
That's right.
And writer, so.
Yeah. No, she and an artist.
She was really instrumental in helping to reshape the vision for how the Clarion Workshops approaches its students, how it approaches getting the new voices out there, you know, so that it's rigorous, but not so much that people are, under duress or crushed, but it's you're pushed and challenged, but, you know, you're nurtured as well. And you're a team. You're working together.
Yeah.
Big ups to Liz for that.
You know, one problem that I have with having you on the air is we seem to be eulogizing people way too often.
I mean, because it's like, when do I see you? And then we'll mention somebody who's like,
well,
like, oh.
Yeah, but I called you very specifically once to talk about doing an Octavia show, and you had been unaware that she had died about a week and a half earlier.
Yeah, because we had just seen her at the Langston Hughes. I mean, she just got an award.
That's right, in
the
March.
Langston Hughes Award. We saw her. I mean, she was, you know, very happy and was, just a wonderful speaker. She's always wonderful to hear.
And I had done an interview with her a week before that in anticipation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was just not anything that was anywhere in the scope of,
possibility.
Possibility at all. And I know she was really happy living in Seattle. She moved to Seattle after our Clarion. She taught Clarion.
Largely thanks to money from the MacArthur grant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she had a really great time in Seattle. And it's a really strong science fiction community there.
Yeah.
And it's like going to Vermont. It's like books everywhere.
Yeah.
Bookstores everywhere. So it's a reader's paradise. And very beautiful. And she just decided to move up there. And so, yeah, that was pretty... pretty shocking, and especially because we were so looking forward to seeing what would happen with Parable of, the last one.
Parable of the Sower.
I think it was Parable of the Trickster.
Oh, the Trickster, yeah.
Yep.
Well, I mean, one of the things that she had told me in that last interview that I did with her, which only runs about half an hour, because I was still doing a two-hour show.
Mm-hmm.
And she was at the Washington Square Hotel, and we were going to record in her room, and her room wasn't available. So we went down to the cafe, and the cafe wasn't open, but they let us sit in there anyway. And there were these very steep steps going down, and this gave her some vertigo.
Mm.
And she's a tall woman, And in that interview, this is not too long after Fledgling had come out. And Fledgling was her first published work in about 9 years. And the reason for that, she said, was that she had had writer's block. Because there was such a burden placed on her that she was carrying the weight of black women's voices and being looked up to in this manner. It was like, okay, what do I do now?
Wow.
And Fledgling came out, and while Fledgling is a wonderful novel with vampiric undertones and all that, among her novels, I would not put it in the top five, let's say. And frankly, she did agree with me. But the point is, it broke the writer's block.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, so you owe me a show. When you come, when you come to New York next, which was in about 3 weeks, she was going to stay for a while after the Langston Hughes Award. We were going to record the rest of the interview. Go back to Seattle, come back to New York, and that didn't happen. But one of the things that she had said in that final interview that I did with her, that I broadcast when you and I were on together after that, which was like the hardest, one of the harder things to hear was, well, thank God the writer's block is over. Now I know how to finish that, and I've got an idea for another new series. And it's like, oh, bleep.
Yeah.
You know,
those are the really, really good things that come out of it. Her family, she and her family were very generous. They donated her, or she had her papers donated to university in California, and they have just opened them up to scholars. And so some of the earlier, you know, news has come out about what, you know, what was in her project file, and you know, it's very interesting stuff. I know Child Finder is out, and it's some previously unpublished earlier short stories of Octavia Butler, and
unless I'm mistaken, aren't her pretty much complete works available as ebooks? I think Open Road, what a surprise, Betsy Mitchell did that. We should explain that Betsy Mitchell was the editor at Warner, which is now Hachette, or Orbit, actually. And she helped bring Octavia to that particular publisher. Hell, she brought Octavia to my house once for an interview. I got to cook for Octavia Butler. That's cool. And she helped Dark Matter.
Helped. He's my editor. They were my editors. Betsy was the one. I was, I think it, and it's so funny because it's like always, every time I talk to you, I always think of their, do you remember Mike Sargent?
Do I remember Mike Sargent?
You know Mike Sargent?
Yeah, yes. He'll be on the air next Monday at midnight. I haven't, he sent me a bizarre, one second. I have to open the door for Lister, whose show comes on right after mine. Don't let the dreadlocks are in the hat.
So. You have to give him a pound from Cherie Renee Thomas, because I was talking to him about what I wanted to do. This is when...
Well, I'm turning off the mic so you can talk to him directly.
Oh, okay.
Or better yet, put on headphones, Lister. Put on headphones, and I'll open your mic and be clean. Be good. Be good.
I'd be
oh,
clean.
My gosh. I can't believe he's there.
Hi.
Well, his show follows mine.
How are you?
Hi, Mike. Hey, it's Cherie. I'm way in Memphis.
I love
it. I'm going to give you another thank you, because you probably don't remember this.
Uh-huh.
But at some point, I was in the studio, and I was chewing your ear off talking about this project I wanted to do, which at the time had no title.
Really?
And it was still kind of, you know, forming together, but I knew what I wanted to do. And I was telling you about it, and you just, I don't know what it was, it's a synchronicity, you know, sometimes when you're just on the right path,
uh-huh.
meet all the people you need to meet. You meet all the people back to back that you need.
Yeah.
And they all have something golden for you, some uh-huh. kind of gem of information. And you said, well, you need to get yourself to, I don't know if it was the Beacon Theater or some theater.
Yeah, I did.
Because Octavia Butler, Walter Mosley, and Jonathan Leeson are going to be speaking today.
Wow, I said that?
At one time. Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember, yeah. But I can't believe that that's what I actually said.
Yeah, you actually said that.
Great.
And that dry tone.
great. Well, I want to wish you a very happy 2015 Jim Freund style right here.
Yeah, I'm wishing for a happy 2015.
Same to you, Jim. Yeah. Man, it sounds good already. Great. So when is the project going to be finished?
When is the project?
That project is what we've been talking about.
Oh, okay. Let's hear it.
That project has been in the world.
But we should say it again for people just
tuning
in. It's on
the second volume. It's won 2 World Fantasy Awards.
Wow.
And I'm just happy to hear that it's even called still being thought of or read today. I mean,
but tell people.
So many great writers that trusted me with their work.
Cherie, I mean, tell people the name of the project and where they can get it.
Dark Matter. Dark Matter, A Century of Speculative Fiction from the African Diaspora.
Wow.
And Octavia Butler supported it. And Samuel Delaney and just so many other writers that didn't know me from a can of paint at
wow.
the time. And it's, you know, it's just...
There's people like Ishmael Reed in there and Amiri Baraka.
Really?
And yeah.
Jim Freund.
I merely championed the book when it came out.
Great.
That's all I did. But yeah. I had nothing to do with the formation.
Where can I get a copy?
Well, funny you should ask.
Uh-huh.
Funny you should ask.
It just came out. It's been out of print for way too long. One day is way too long.
Uh-huh.
But it's now available as an ebook.
Oh, good. All right.
Mm-hmm. So this tops everybody's... holiday gift.
Yes.
Even the non-religious have holidays.
I mean, it's got Charles Chestnut in it, and W.E.B. Du Bois is in it.
Yeah, that was one of the things that really just blew me over. It's like W.E.B. Du Bois actually wrote Spec Fic, and yeah, he had a piece called The Comet.
Let me ask you a question. Who did you want to squeeze in that didn't get squeezed into this?
Oh, there are quite a few people that I wasn't able to include for various reasons. I mean, the book ended up being 427 pages.
Whoa.
And that's with me cutting still.
And that's just volume one.
Really?
And that was just, that was the only one I thought. I didn't ever anticipate that there was going to be another one. So, uh-huh. You know, this was like, you know, that had to represent the time. And... some of the work that I referenced in my introduction, are really like respected the writers or what have you, but the works weren't necessarily short fiction. They were part of larger works, and it's really a challenge sometimes to excerpt a novel in a way that really does justice to the entire work and gives readers that kind of, you know, experience that you want them to have.
So did you choose the excerpt from the Ishmael Reed from Future Christmas?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Black No More, George Schuyler.
Yeah, I did all the editing. I mean, there's no doubt I did all the editing of it.
So it's not that these writers said, oh, you know, it would work well.
No, they didn't even know Mindscape. I was going to reach out to them. Like, no one, like, the idea, like, I don't think, you know, Ishmael Reed woke up and said, I'm a science fiction writer or a speculative fiction writer, what have you. I had, had to contact people and have conversations with them and see what they thought about it, you know. Of being a part of the collection or what have you. Very supportive. Amir Baraka was very supportive. Wanda Coleman, very supportive. So I was very happy with the response. But it was just like you were asking, Mike, some things I had to leave out. I had to leave out Sudden E. Griggs just because it was 19th century, writing that didn't really match the tone and rhythm of some of the other works, and it was very difficult to figure out what would be a great excerpt for that. So I just referenced it. I talked about Douglas Turner Ward's Day of Absence, which we know mostly from theater, but it's not something I felt like I needed to reproduce in the collection. You know, and then there was another writer that Charles Saunders,
who wrote both an essay and fiction.
To get in touch with him. because he had been so quiet, I mean, people weren't aware, you know, that he was doing all this amazing stuff in Nova Scotia. They actually thought he had died, and he hadn't. He's living well and writing. But he was the one who you know, got me, you know, interested in some other writers. And this is another young woman I was trying to get in touch with, published some sword and sorcery kind of fantasy, African fantasy, in the 80s, around the time that Stephen Barnes was publishing his work and when Charles was publishing. And she had just gone on to, like, she had a different life, and she really just didn't want to her work reprinted. So I had to say bye-bye to that one.
Yeah, that's sad, but some people, that's how they are.
Yeah.
And I mean, I could totally understand and respect that.
I'm such an extrovert. My world's job, my job in this world, is to bring people to the public that they otherwise might not have known, which is a little bit of what Dark Matter did as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so when somebody says, no, I'd rather, you know, stay in my corner over here, I pout.
Oh, well, I didn't have the luxury for pounding because, you know, deadlines, dear. And plus, like I said, that people try to say, well, you know, oh, the collection's about this, or black writers or black science fiction writers, they think that, and da 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 da. No, dear. If Niecy Shaw has sent me, Niecy could have sent me many different stories because she doesn't write this one kind of short story.
No, you know, she's very diverse.
Tananarive Redu sent me more than one story. They were very different. You know what I mean?
How do you choose?
That is a good question. I went with the story I felt that would have the strongest impact on readers, and it was probably the most distinctive.
Yeah, I'd like
and
Daughter.
I also had to think about what other things that I already, you know, had accepted. And so I didn't want a lot of repetition of the same themes necessarily, or the same, you know, area. So I wanted, you know, to have a sense of the diversity of thought and aesthetics in it. So, yeah.
And yet you also did a little bit of showcasing. I mean, the Delaney story you've got in there, I and Gamora, that's one of his best stories.
Yeah. And it's one of my favorites.
Same here.
The Corona. Yeah. Corona. Yeah.
Corona, but also I and Gamora.
Mm-hmm.
You did both, did you not?
Not in the same volume.
No, in two different... Yeah. Right. Corona was in volume two, but I and Gamora in the first.
Yeah.
And Corona is lesser known, but just as... it's fascinating. Well, all of his work is fascinating.
How long this took? 2 years to do, complete?
Oh, God, no.
No, I thought about it. I started conceiving it in 98. I didn't actually start compiling it until 99.
Wow.
And it came out in July 1st, 2000.
Really? Right. Wow. And the second book was what, 2003?
That was July 1st, 2004.
Oh, 2004. So it's like 3 years.
We did a hardcover and a paper.
3 years.
The paper edition came out in 2001
mm-hmm.
for the first one.
Yes.
And then I didn't start working on the second one until maybe a year and a half later.
Now, the last time we spoke on the air, I had a question which you scoffed at, and I'll ask it again, and you're going to scoff at me again.
I scoff.
Yeah. Well, you know what the question is. Number three.
Oh.
Yes, that was a scoff. You see that? You just scoffed at me, Cherie. Because, I mean, on the one hand, yeah, okay, so who cares? It's 3 years out of your life. There's all of us out of here that need you to do more books. I'm selfish. You know me.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And
it was just like, I mean, well, I had a particular thing that I wanted to do with the third one, and I just feel like There's a lot of amazing, interesting stuff happening right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When I did Dark Matter, there wasn't any Dark Matter. There wasn't any other Dark Matter.
Right.
People were barely even want to acknowledge that they liked science fiction and, you know, were of color. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And they were, like, when they saw each other, they would go and grasp each other and say, oh, you like this, too? And then share, you know, I read this, in exchange. It wasn't like it was some kind of cool thing of people running around with T-shirts. That wasn't happening.
No. No, not even at the Lunarians, gave you help. And I was a member of the Lunarians in the early days. And we had, we had the token member. In other words, and you could go to Lunacon, and actually there were quite a few black people in the early 70s at Lunacon attending, but not writing. And I don't think that it ever occurred to any of them that they were fandom, science fiction fandom, the geek group, is already so far out, especially in that era, of the community of accepted people, that to be both a black and a geek at the same time, it was like, well, it was hardly a step further. But it never occurred to them, I think, that they could be writers, except in the zines that they were sharing with each other.
I just think it's about community, and, you know, there's always going to be people who are like, they're going to go wherever they want to. They don't care if there's, you know, there's any other role models or whatever. Just, I remember Octavia Butler saying that, you know, she wasn't necessarily waiting for a role model, you know, to write her work. You know what I mean?
Because,
She wrote, you know, the stories she wanted to read. And so you're always going to find, there's always going to be those people who are just, they're there. They're doing what you're doing.
It may have been her who said, you know, I wanted to find books with me in it. That quote I threw out earlier, that may have actually come from her, because I remember the thing that got her writing was seeing some horrid, horrid science fiction movie on TV and being aware that A, she could write better than that, and B, there was no image of her that would fit in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the founders of the Carl Brandon Society, I'm sure, you know, when they were going to, you know, the science fiction, like Wisconsin or what have you, you know, there were a lot of people that were, you could say, were, you know, writers of color or readers of color. But each year, you know, they were doing all their hard work, you know, and doing that kind of advocacy and just letting people know, this is the work that's being published. This is, you know, these are the people you can read or what have you. More and more people started coming. It's to the point where, you know, their writer of a color dinner that they have, you know, there's just, it's like a room full of people. I don't know if there was like 75 people, 100. I don't know. But they have seen the change. You know, they've seen the growth over the years. So that's very satisfying. And, you know, they give out $1,000 awards for the Octavia Butler Award for a writer of color who's doing, you know, did some amazing work in science fiction. And they also have a Parallax Award, which is also, the Kindred Award. I think the Kindred Award is for the writer of color. I think the Parallax Award is for any writer of any background who is doing some interesting stuff exploring race their science fiction and speculative fiction. And that's, you know.
In the same way that the James Tiptree Award celebrates people who are writing about gender, but they don't have to be identified.
It's feminist science fiction.
Or gay science fiction or whatever it may be. Let me ask you this. Where are the problem pre-dark matter, you know, this invisible universe that many of us who were in the universe, it's why the name dark matter is so perfect. We didn't know this other stuff was in our universe. What is there within the science fiction, and when we say science fiction, we mean fantasy, horror, speculative, the whole nine yards. What barriers, what parts of the invisible universe do we yet have to find?
Wow. That's a really good question. I really don't know, because, I can't say that I've read all the science fiction that's coming out from these writers. There are several groups, Black Science Fiction Society, and Science Fiction Noir is another group.
Right.
A long time ago was...
But beyond simply people of color,
I'll tell you.
I mean, what I'm saying is there's a lot of work that's being published, self-published, independently published, and being published by small presses, and in some of the work that's coming out of the major houses.
Yeah.
I have not read all of it. There was a period when I was before Dark Matter, I could say, and I literally walked into a Barnes & Noble and said, you know, looking for more black science fiction. And I said, read this, read that. I've got all of this. Where's new stuff?
But there's
new stuff. You've read it all in terms of it, you know, what's being published. Maybe not in short, you know, fiction that might have been in some random literary journal or something, but you've read the books that are out. Can't say that today.
Exactly. I submit that we have you to thank for that. I think that you opened that gate that changed the publishing industry and the way that people, both writers and readers, thought about science fiction. I know you've never really, like, said, yes, I did, and I don't expect you to, but let me say it as an observer, you did that. So I really think that there's a before and after. I think there are many people who have not heard of Dark Matter whose lives have been affected by it.
Well, I just hope that that's really gratifying to hear because it's certainly not anything that I had imagined when I was working on it. I just really wanted to have a collection of short fiction or what have you that I, you know, that put it all in one place, you know, and that I can enjoy, just like so many other anthologies I read at the time. And being able to see that so much new work has come out, and that I remember having a conversation at some point. You were talking about Octavia Butler feeling the pressure of all those adoring faces who really respect and admire her work. And she's like, oh, I've got to write this third volume. And now all these people are waiting on it or what have you. And then writing Fledgling.
And being called, getting what they call the genius grant, a name she hated.
Yeah.
It's like, how about a fine writer's grant, but being called, you know, the MacArthur grant, she got the genius grant, and that was immensely.
What a wonderful experience. I mean, wow.
Yeah, it's great for us, but for her, it was, oh, don't call me that. It was like, that's where a lot of the pressure came. If they had called it anything other than the genius grant, it might have been better. Not that she turned down the money.
I don't know. You think she was... I don't know. It's just, you know.
Yeah, I've got her on tape saying that. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah, I don't think that. I can back it up.
Wow. I remember
I've got the audio citation for
Yari. It's a, you know, wonderful, like, I forget how often. They maybe do it every 4 years, that Organization of African Women's Writers organizes. And I think it's affiliated with NYU.
Uh-huh.
But she was, like, the major guest. And that room, I kid you not, from the wall to the ceiling, from the back to the front, that room was packed. You could barely get in. I mean, and it was just like all these, you know, scholars and readers and fans and booksellers. We talk about Jen Brissett. Jen gave up Dark Matter our very first reading in Brooklyn at her bookstore, Indigo Bookstore.
Yeah.
You know, always have a special place in my heart because she was so generous to do that. And we're like, everybody was there. And we're just like, you know, it's like fangirl city.
And everybody, and here is Jen now with her first novel out, Elysium, just out in trade paper from Aqueduct Press. We need to promote everybody here.
I mean, this is the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like I said, it's just like the new year. It's going to have a lot of exciting work. All these pioneers that we're talking about, Octavia Butler, you know, Stephen Barnes and Honoré Du, and Nalo Hopkinson,
Keeney, Burisalam.
I mean, just being able to...
A name that I haven't even said because I know I'll blow it and somebody...
Jewel Gomez?
No, Nettie. Help me with her name.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. Are you saying
Nettie.
Nettie? Nettie Okorafor?
Thank you.
All right, yeah.
I have. There's another person, along with Tanana Reeve, who I've never met, who I expect either you and or Terrence to introduce me to so I can bow and record. But so many people I have met, I have learned through your work that have enriched my life. And, yeah, I think that you're responsible for a lot of that, that you – science fiction is supposed to open people to other possibilities other than what they see right in front of them. It's supposed to expand imagination and get people to realize that there is a hidden world out there, sometimes very, very, very unjust, which is certainly something that the last 4 months – have provided proof of, and sometimes joyful, which I'm hoping 2015 will bring a little bit of. And yeah, you brought a lot of that there. So
well, I mean, I really, you know, I have to say, you know, you got to thank the writers for, you know. They didn't have to submit the work. They didn't have to do that at all. So that was because when you submit to an anthology, sometimes you have no idea who else is going to be.
But you see, encapsulating it in one place. I mean, a lot. Yeah. You know, some of the anthologies that I named at the top of the show were not new fiction. Especially Judith Merrill's work, The Best of the Best. But what she did was she got translators and found Japanese science fiction. And, you know, she was bringing us new voices, new places, and it's like, wow. And that story is 125 years old. I did not know that people were doing that before, you know, when Hugo Gernsback was published, or let's do a better one, Edgar Rice Burroughs is writing this unknowingly horribly racist material. It'll be interesting.
Unknowingly.
Well, you know, for 1903, society is blind to it. But it's going to be, you know,
what he was writing, but we'll leave that.
You know, there's a new Tarzan movie coming out next year, right? And what the producers are saying is it's going to be in a realistic version of the Congo, where with King Leopold and all of that.
Oh, that's interesting.
It could be very, very good. It could be very, very not good.
It's interesting.
Yeah. We were talking about pressure early, and what I wanted to say was that I remember having a conversation with Juno Diaz. I think it was like at some point around the time he had been traveling to South Africa, what have you, and he was working on major manuscript that had been taking him a long time, you know, to complete. And part of it, I think we were talking about, was this idea that it didn't fit comfortably in a particular genre. It wasn't Drown. It wasn't the New Yorker stories that had made him famous. It was something totally different. It dealt with, like, you know, this kind of, you know, a character you don't see often in literature, you know, a comic book nerd, what have you, you know, different culture, you know, it has some speculative elements to it. And he, you know, they weren't necessarily quite sure how that was going to work out.
Yeah.
We're talking about Juno Diaz. You understand what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
Walter Mosley went to a totally different publisher from his mysteries because they weren't quite sure how his science fiction would, you know, how his mystery audience would take his science fiction. So it's like you have these major writers who even they have to navigate skepticism when they are, you know, trying to write science fictional works. How do you imagine what it's like for new writers out there?
Yeah, exactly. You know what I
mean? So. So, you just have to be brave and continue to believe in the story that you're trying to tell.
Well, you hear that music in the background? Do you realize the show's over?
All right. The sun's not up because it's a different time.
Yeah. It's time for Lister and Burn Baby Burn Clap.
Congratulations on the book. Congratulations.
Thank you. Well,
it's finally being an ebook. Again, everybody, the name of the book is Dark Matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the most important books ever published in science fiction, period, bar none. I mean that. It is required reading, or else don't listen to this show, please. it's now available as an ebook. The editor and my guest this morning is Cherie Renee Tuiz Thomas. And we're going to get you in New York at some point over the next 8 months or something, right?
Yes, yes, yes. I'll be in Northampton. I'll be at Smith College.
Yeah.
I'll be riding up a storm.
Good.
And, So hopefully, Leo, my first love, my
My oldest daughter is in New York, so yeah, I'll be there.
Oh, she is. She's still here. Cool. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So, and say hi to Jada.
I will.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank Bye-bye. You so much, Cherie. Take care. Good night. And this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you for listening. I can say this now with her off the phone. Cherie Renee Thomas is, again, one of the most important people to change the face of science fiction, and most importantly, to change the color of it, or rather, to add new color to it and new universes. And there's a movie coming out. We'll talk about that at some point soon.
Really?
But thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper. Don't know what I'm doing on the show next week or the week after, but we'll be here. Good morning. Take good care of yourselves. Please, people, be good to each other.
And can you play the theme back? It's my favorite tune.
Play it again.
I love it. Play it again,
okay,
Sam.
I'll play it again, Sam. Play it again so we can
It's
all
so
hear
nice
it.
We had to do it
it's
twice.
It's still Ice Fan, yeah. Very often my December outro is Solstice Bells. But no, okay, we'll play
I love this tune. Again. It's yeah. really, really, really good.
There it is.
Thank
okay.
you.
In
you.
Full volume now.
Yes.
And everybody stay tuned for the great segue that Lister will do into the next show. And enjoy.
Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah. Oh, yes. And by the way, check out the Hour of the Wolf page on Facebook. And you can even visit ourwolf.com, the unupdated website. Good morning.
Too black, too strong, causing mass hysteria. pressure, trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth put on hold. The bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledged allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk my people, the people all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Burn the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. Cause my hurt is eternal. The American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison? Cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy. I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why trying to scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
Yeah. the promises made. The more that you sink, can't be helped to be saved. Rain from the skies can bring new life, but we can bring the ocean closer. The waves cannot be frozen.
99 cents for this delight.
Your senses and the sweetest days will be yours.
List alive right here, flag burning time, 9 minutes after 3 o'clock. Great show, Jim Froyen. New York City. List Alive 99 Sink of Burn Baby Burn. It's cold outside. Whoa. Slight snow coming down. Up in Warwick, it's ice on the road. It's skidding. Be careful.
Once away.